When the historian Jill Lepore was mapping out an idea for a podcast, she said she wanted it to sound like history. And not just because a lot of historical events have been recorded, but that an archive itself has a sound. She says it's like the crackle of a record or that freaky noise when a piece of tape gets warped. And Lepore spent a lot of time sifting through dusty documents and relics. In fact, she calls the podcast The Last Archive.
There's a place in our world where the known things go. A corridor of the mind. I haven't been down here in a while, but it's good to be back. Down here where the walls are lined with shelves, cluttered with proof. Especially books. On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. Oh, and right next to that, The Menace of Darwinism by William Jennings Bryan. More of a pamphlet, really. Here's a skeleton of a chimpanzee, its bones held together by wire, like a necklace of beads. This place, this evidence room, stores the facts that matter, and matters of fact. It's all that stands between a reasonable doubt and the chaos of ignorance.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jill Lepore's podcast has just started its second season. It follows from the first, where she explored the truth and how we lost hold of the truth. Basically, she goes back through history and she investigated who killed the truth. And if you haven't listened to that first season, you really should. It's great. And it's no spoiler to say everyone had a hand in the killing. Now, in the second season, Lepore examines doubt, how it has grown throughout the past 100 years, and how we ended up at this pivotal moment when rioters, inflamed by disbelief in the results of a presidential election, stormed the U.S. Capitol building. Jill Lepore is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. She's also a professor of American history at Harvard University, where she teaches a course on the history of evidence. And so we began with this conversation about her affection for an archive.
I find that the intimacy and humanity of the physical archive is really powerful for me. Like if I'm reading somebody's diary in the archive and I'm holding it in my hands and I can see, you know, the tear stains on a page or the smudge of M&Ms that's been squished in there. Like I have a connection to the person I'm reading about. So I have kind of a real love for that kind of evidence, artifactual evidence, manuscript evidence, physical evidence of any kind, forensic evidence. You know, it's why I like police procedurals. Like I like figuring out how the clues, I like the police watching people gather clues and put together a story around that. And yet we live in a world in which not only is so much of how we perceive the world brought to us in a very abstract and ethereal and digital form, but we, I think, are often asked to be oriented always toward the future. We live in a kind of weirdly future-focused moment in history, and I'm a historian, so I'm really interested in the past. So the idea for calling the podcast The Last Archive was there is actually still knowledge to be found in the study of people who are dead, in the study of long ago things, in the study of long dormant objects, in the study of little red pieces of paper, that not all knowledge is to be found by way of, you know, machine learning and AI, that there is still knowledge to be found in these old, ancient, antique, creaky, dusty, smelly, filthy, shabby places. And I really wanted, the podcast begins, imagine a place. Like I wanted to use the format of audio, which I adore, right? Like I love, that's one of the things I love about radio, right? Is that intimacy. I wanted to bring that intimacy of audio to the idea of a place that holds the past.
I wanted to ask you that because you mentioned, you have this affection for like police procedurals, but you also clearly have an affection for radio. And that really comes through in this second season. One of the things I think you've said is you talked about how you wanted the show to sound like history, that history sounds like archives. And the radio part really does come through in this second season. I think you've described it, or someone described it on the show, as this kind of obsession for radio and really great and we'll get into this a little bit later, but some of the really great like radio drama of the 1930s.
I adore radio drama. Like if I'm listening to a book on tape, I always look first to see if there's a radio drama adaptation of it.
Wow.
I really love radio drama. Like I think it's an incredibly ingenious adaptation of audio. So the podcast was a way both to kind of play with, or has been a way both to play with the real thrill of the form. And it's just really endless capacity, but also to use the study of radio and the controversy over radio in its early decades as a metaphorical way to look at our own problems.
Yeah. So last season was about truth and, you know, who killed it. And in the end, you say, you know, basically everyone has a hand in the killing. But what was the pivot point to doubt? Because now you're focusing on doubt. Maybe explain what you wanted to get at in this second season that, you know, that flows from that first one.
Yeah, I think we had always thought of the podcast as having a three-season structure and a kind of thesis, antithesis, synthesis structure, where the first season was going to sort of be essentially a criminal investigation, a kind of whodunit into who killed truth, and that we'd look at episodes over the course of the 20th century, the last 100 years, sort of decade by decade. And that's what we did, and it was really fun. And it sounds a little bit like a cop out to say that, you know, everyone had a hand in it, but it turns out that that's actually sort of the case.
Yeah.
And then what we wanted to do in the second season was, it's almost like reopening a case, right? Like go back over the same body of evidence, the same decades of history, but looking at everything sort of upside down. It was sort of felt like, okay, well, in season one, we started out on our left foot. And on season one, every step we took, like we started on our right foot. So everything is like a half step off. So what we were looking for in season two was not people that were sort of specifically, you know, attacking truth claims, but people who are just almost thoughtlessly and heedlessly sowing doubt, just undermining institutions, sources of arbitration of knowledge, and sometimes purposefully. I mean, sometimes quite purposefully. In the season, there's some very villainous actors who are doing that, but sometimes in ways of knowing were just sort of almost inadvertently undermined. So each story in the second season looks at, again, like a moment in a decade across the last 100 years. You know, there's conspiracy theorists and hoaxers and propagandists, and they're all doing different sorts of things, and their ability to do it changes pretty dramatically over time, and they have quite different motives in doing it. But sort of sitting down and kind of tracing that decade by decade ended up, for me as a historian, showing me a pattern of the emergence of a kind of deep, paralyzing doubt that I hadn't seen before.
Hmm. So why start with the Scopes monkey trial of 1925? And maybe you could explain how skeptic, because this one's kind of about skepticism. But first, explain how doubt works, because you sort of work through that a bit in this first episode. You describe belief and doubt as being partners. You know, the idea that you have to believe something before you can doubt it. Is this powerful idea of belief, I guess you encounter that in that story of those believers in Dayton, Tennessee, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really the natural place to start. So the Scopes trial is in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee. People do generally know the story. John Scopes was a high school teacher who assigned a textbook in a biology class, and the textbook taught the theory of evolution. The Tennessee legislature had passed a law banning the teaching of any theory of the origins of humankind that contradicted the Bible. And he was arrested, and then in this big show trial that was set up by the ACLU, which was new at the time, he was tried in Dayton. The prosecution was conducted by the famed populist candidate for president, William Jennings Bryan, a fundamentalist who'd supported these evolution teaching bans. And the defense was conducted by the most famous lawyer in the country, Clarence Darrow. The Scopes trial was broadcast live by radio. It's the first trial ever to be broadcast. None of the recordings exist, so our first episode consists largely of a radio drama reenactment from the trial transcripts of the trial itself. And the reason I picked it as the the launching point for the second season of The Last Archive is, I mean, it's just an incredibly cool story.
Yeah.
It's like a very dramatic trial.
Gentlemen and Mr. Attorney General, I am now calling for trial, the state of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes.
Scopes had been charged with violating a law that stipulated, well, just listen to it.
Be it enacted by the General Assembly of the state of Tennessee that it shall be unlawful for any teacher to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man, as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man is descended from a lower order of animals.
There's a thousand, like, kind of narrative reasons to start with that story. But the intellectual reason is that I think it gave me a good opportunity to introduce some kind of key dimensions of what becomes several of the problems over the course of the 20th century that we have inherited. One is the really kind of unfinished business of reckoning with Darwinism. Mm-hmm. There's this very deep and long and strong tradition of belief in a very different story about the origins of humankind that was never really, certainly in the United States, taken literally until after Darwinism. And people think, you know, sometimes, well, fundamentalism has always been around and fundamentalists believe in the literal truth of the Bible. Yes, you know, God really did create the earth in 7 days, and they mean 7 days or 7 days. But that's actually not the case. Like, the Bible was generally understood to be an allegory, a series of parables, some stories that helped us to understand our human origins. But it's actually after Darwin's Origin of Species, which is 1859, that fundamentalism begins to emerge as a kind of counter to Darwinism. Hmm. And I thought that was really interesting because we have such a long shadow cast by fundamentalism in American culture because of, for instance, originalism. The way conservatives read the Constitution is essentially a legal version of fundamentalism, right? We should read the Constitution in the same way that fundamentalists read the Bible.
Yeah.
What the kind of conflict between fundamentalists and people, you can't say believe in evolution, right? Like, because you don't believe in science, like trust science is always strikes me as the most bizarre thing to say. Like, you don't trust anything if you have a scientific mind, right? You investigate it and you submit the evidence before you to the powers of your own reason and to duplication and verification. But, you know, people that thought it was the right thing to do to teach the theory of evolution have a very different way of understanding the stories of the Bible. And so much of what comes down to us today from now nearly a century ago, that trial, is a kind of ongoing culture war.
Yeah.
About how we know things.
You say that you believe what was on trial in 1925 was skepticism itself. And the role of doubt in a democracy. Explain that. Explain, because you talk about the idea of skepticism here. How does skepticism fit?
Yeah, so skepticism, right, we accept as like the healthy kind of scrutiny that we give to information that's presented to us.
Yeah.
You might say to me, it's going to snow in Boston tomorrow, Jill. I've heard that. I heard that online. And I would say, well, I'm going to have to look into that because I'm not so persuaded that in the middle of May we're going to have a snowstorm here. It's not impossible. It's happened before. But, I would be skeptical of that claim, and I would therefore need to do some empirical investigation of it. And I would look for sources of authority, trusted sources of authority, that I would go to that might help me understand whether – and I might be curious where you got that information, and we would have an exchange about it. And then we would have the chance to verify your prediction, because the weather would come tomorrow and it would be one kind of weather or another. One of us would be right, one of us would be wrong. We understand that as a kind of healthy kind of doubting, right? You shouldn't just trust things that people say to you. You trust certain people who have privileged information because they have expertise or they are very wise, or, you know, there's a lot of different ways that people can know things and you can expect that they know a lot of things. So there's skepticism, and then there's this. What I think happens with the Scopes trial is you begin to see the way in which one of the things that certain fundamentalists are doing is just selling doubt, like just saying you shouldn't believe these fancy pantsy city folk who want to tell you that the Bible isn't true. And in fact, you know, what if you look more carefully at what's going on during the debate around, you know, what we would now call creationism, but wasn't called that then, in 1925, is it actually is much more complicated than it appears. Because, of course, Darwinism isn't inconsistent with the Bible, yeah. right? And that's what the trial ended up having to be about. It wasn't that at stake at the trial was proving that evolution was true. What had to be litigated at trial was whether the theory of evolution contradicts the Bible, and it really doesn't. But what Clarence Darrow decided to do was try to prove that the idea that the Bible was true was a bad idea.
The state of Tennessee, under an honest and fair interpretation of the Constitution, has no more right to teach the Bible as the divine book than that the Quran is one, or the Book of Mormons, or the Book of Confucius, or the Buddha, or the essays of Emerson, or any one of the 10,000 books to which human souls have gone for consolation and aid in their troubles.
So he did really wage this kind of full-throated attack on Christianity, or certainly on fundamentalism. And one of the things that, you know, I find really fascinating about fundamentalism, and especially about William Jennings Bryan, who I don't think really understood that much about Darwinism, what Bryan did was sort of conflate Darwinism and social Darwinism. So social Darwinism is this sort of eugenics belief in the survival of the fittest among humans. Social Darwinism, you know, led to forced sterilization of people in mental institutions or people convicted of crimes or, you know, people of color. So social Darwinism is horrible. And we would all agree that social Darwinism is horrible. Bryan thought that social Darwinism was horrible. And if evolution was taught in the schools, that what these poor rural kids in Tennessee were being taught was, you're poor because you're always going to be poor because you're just not made of good stock.
There is not a scientist in all the world who can trace one single species to any other. And yet they call us ignoramuses and bigots because we do not throw away our Bible. The one beauty about the Word of God is it does not take an expert to understand it.
And so I think, like, sympathetically for me to think about fundamentalists, among the things they were trying to do was protect their children from a kind of teaching that they thought was teaching their children that they were worthless and less than fully human. And there's a kind of nobility in that. And then the contempt that the evolutionary arguers have is really actually for the poor. I think it's a much more mixed story. And looking at it from these different angles, instead of just accepting the terms of the culture war that we have largely inherited, like this was an epic battle between ignorance and knowledge, between science and superstition. It actually wasn't that. Or it was many other things aside from being that.
Well, I think that's the most important point, at least that I drew from this section, was that it's like you had these two sides in this gulf in American culture. Clarence Darrow, sort of, he's the skeptic, he's the rationalist, he's the agnostic, you know. And then you have William Jennings Bryan, who represents kind of fundamentalism. And for those people, I'm thinking of public radio audiences, they're going to be delighted by Darrow's side. You know, him orating like a prophet, you say. And as you mentioned yourself, you were all in on this sort of rational idea. But the thing that's so great about this, you know, this episode is that you talk about how in some ways what Darrow ends up doing is just being contemptuous and mocking of people, that it turns out that really this is a show trial and this was just a culture war. And you say a culture war never really arrives at the truth. People just love to be in the skirmish. And that seems like exactly where we are right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we had a similar trial today, the press would cover it in a similarly divided way, yeah. right? You know, our culture war takes different forms. I mean, think about, say, the Brett Kavanaugh, Christine Blasey Ford hearings. Right? Like, I think that the Scopes trial worked a little bit like that, in that everybody was watching and listening. And, you know, it's like, was the dress blue or was the dress gold? Like, somehow there's this kind of wild disconnect where something about this, the standards of evidence and the rules of how you know things in these two realms, that is to say, faith in the book of Genesis versus scientific inquiry into the fossil record, they kind of bang up against one another. And who's to decide, yeah, right? Like, what? So what's fascinating about the Scopes trial is that it intersects with our ideas about who arbitrates knowledge. So on the one hand, there's like 12 guys, like there's 12 white farmers, all men, who are the jury trial that's going to decide this case. And you're, you know, who thinks they could be on that jury? Like, who's going to decide, is the theory of evolution, does it contradict the truth of the book of Genesis? I mean, that's a pretty big question for, you know, a jury of 12 people to decide. I'm not like, who's qualified? Like, they, you know, they convict Scopes, like that's, he's not acquitted. It's just, it's, no, they convict him. Yeah. But it's kind of fascinating. Then you also think about, well, what about the other arbiter, which was the Tennessee State Legislature, which decided that it would be illegal to teach the theory of evolution. And you're like, who are they to decide that? But we do live in a democracy where, you know, we elect representatives to make decisions about things like the public schools, which cannot establish religion, right? That we have state, well, in the case of Tennessee, you had a state religious freedom provision in a state constitution. But what are at the edges of that? Like, our courts are riddled now with religious freedom cases all the time because this issue is very much still with us. But if you are basically asking the state of Tennessee as an elected legislature to decide whether evolution, the theory of evolution, is knowledge that can be taught in schools. And I mean, I would say, like, I think evolutionary theory should be taught in schools. Like, it's completely non-controvertible, sure, to me. And I don't think that's inconsistent with any possible set of religious ideas. But we do live in a system where the majority gets to decide. Yeah. So then you have this, the kind of freedom of thought intersecting with the majority rule. So that's where we are sort of today. I mean, think about, say, the idea that that Trump was legitimately elected and the election was stolen by Democrats, yeah, and that Biden is not the rightful president. You know, actually, if enough state legislatures and state courts had been willing to overturn the election results, that would have become reality, yeah, right? Like, we do live in a majority rule system. Fortunately, like, the rules of evidence in those state courts that were inspected, you know, by bodies of justices who were both Republicans and Democrats are intact. And they looked at the evidence and, like, there is no evidence of election fraud. Joseph Biden won the election. We're on the very hairy edge of what happens when majority rule and how we know whether something's true or not bump into one another in ways that lead the majority to say, white is black and black is white.
Jill Lepore. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and a professor of American history at Harvard University. Her podcast is The Last Archive. The second season just got underway a few weeks ago. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help, donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the historian Jill Lepore. The second season of her podcast, The Last Archive, has now started, where she journeys through the archives of history to explore the evolution of doubt in the past century. Well, let's talk about episode 2, which is you really get into radio and I guess the role radio plays in this question of doubt. It takes a while to get there, but I wanted to jump forward to Orson Welles understanding radio and the role radio plays. It's so we're in the early days of radio, and people are, as you said, kind of like all technology when it first comes, people are freaking out about what it means. What role is radio playing in doubt? And what was it that Orson Welles, do you think, understood about that?
Well, radio is really the first networked tool of communication. Yeah. I mean, there before radio, there's telegraph and the telephone, but those are kind of point to point. But radio is broadcast, right? And the metaphor meaningfully comes from farming, right? Like you broadcast seeds. And what was significant about radio in its early development in the 20s was how fully it reached rural communities and how huge that was for people living in really isolated places, especially during the 1930s when people were really suffering economically. It was, of course, crucial to FDR's New Deal that he, you know, spoke to people by radio days after taking office in March of 1933.
That will greatly ease the mortgage distress among the farmers and among the homeowners of the nation. By providing for the easing of the burden of debt that now bears so heavily upon millions of our people.
People would say, you know, about FDR's fireside chats, that if you were in a city and you walked down a city block, you could reliably expect not to miss a word of FDR's address, because between every car driving by, every business that would have a loudspeaker on the front door, every house that would have a radio sitting on a windowsill, someone listened while cooking dinner. You would just go from radio to radio to radio to radio. You wouldn't miss a breath that he took in the middle of one of those speeches. So its ubiquity is really, I think, hard for us to understand at a time when before radio, you know, there really aren't national newspapers. Like, there's just not the kind of distribution capability. You know, you find out even a Supreme Court decision a few days later, right? Things that we take for granted as having been instantaneous. The annihilation of distance that radio spelled meant that, and for many people, it was thought that it would be instrumental towards, certainly for Herbert Hoover, who was a great promoter of the radio during his time as Secretary of Commerce and later president, that it would bind the nation together, that the long-sought unity that would hold this sprawling democracy together would be made possible by radio. And, you know, that happened and it didn't happen. But meanwhile, what everybody understood was happening was that stuff that, you remember when the internet first started and there was like this kind of like running joke of like, well, it must be true, I read it on the internet.
Yeah.
And people, so like, this is like 1997, people would say that jokingly, but they also kind of meant it, because it was like just so cool when it first started, and you could, like, the first search engines like Mosaic and Neck, you could look things up and you're like, wow, I didn't know that Calvin Coolidge was from Vermont. Like, maybe he isn't, but like you read that on the internet. Yeah. And radio had that same like thrill. Like there's this thing that can tell me anything. It was like Alexa, but it was incredible. And there's like so much stuff on the radio, and so much of it was educational. And incredibly ambitious educationally, and including bringing theater. So the first radio theater was like, you know, like someone would just record a production of Shakespeare and then you could listen to it. It's like, and music was all like, you know, live music you'd be listening to. It was just like phenomenal. The world just exploded almost overnight for people. But psychologists began to think, wow, if you hear something on the radio, you're going to think it's true. But what if it's not? Like, what if somebody gets a hold of a microphone and they start lying to you? Which, of course, is what happens in Germany, where Joseph Goebbels like requires every German household to have a radio. And he has basically a button on his desk where he can pipe into every household in Germany his message at any time. He's the minister of propaganda for the Third Reich. And he uses radio unbelievably effectively to tell people what to believe. And so there was a growing concern about the psychology of radio, whether radio was promoting stereotypes and divisions, promoting false beliefs. And Welles, who was involved in, you know, the best and most innovative theatrical productions on the radio, you know, when he staged War of the Worlds in 1938, and people mistook it, at least some people certainly mistook it for an actual news report of an invasion from Mars, he said, afterward that that had been intentional, that what he was trying to do was alert people to the danger of radio. Like, remember when Elizabeth Warren did some fake Facebook post when she said, maybe she said Mark Zuckerberg had just endorsed her for president or something, yeah. Or maybe that Mark Zuckerberg had just endorsed Trump or something like that. Like, she just put some lie out on Facebook just to say, like, you can say anything on Facebook. And it didn't exactly prove
it didn't land. Point. Yeah.
But it's a little bit like when people do those deep fakes, you know, that like Jordan Peele deep fake video where Jordan Peele makes Obama and like there's like a whole. It doesn't actually really work to raise an alarm because people are like, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, I think, what people thought about War of the Worlds. But that was Wells's argument in any case. And some journalists received it that way and said, like, this is a very sobering story about how dangerous radio can really be.
Yeah. There's a great part in this episode I wanted to ask you about where, you know, you sort of explore voices on the radio who were faking it or not telling the truth. You know, we got characters like Charlie Chan from that era, and then there's Ripley's Believe It or Not, and it was hard to know whether to actually believe that. But you say there were those who were real, and among them is a character that I have to say I didn't know about, Pedro Gonzalez. Starts this radio show in 1929, and you write in the piece or talk about in the podcast the kind of the warmth and humor of this story of Pedro Gonzalez. Talk a little bit about that part.
Yeah, so radio was pretty freewheeling, certainly before the FCC, which is established in 1934. It's extremely multilingual. It's a little bit more like community access kind of stuff. So Pedro Gonzalez had been born in Mexico, moved to LA in the 20s, was a singer, an incredibly talented singer, and was in a band. And he first got hired to work on the radio doing Spanish language ads. So singing basically jingles, advertising jingles, because the Mexican audience in LA was huge. And he liked doing these little jingles, but he wanted to do his own radio show. And he had a radio show that started at 4 a.m. and he had it for years. And it was really pitched to migrant farm workers who would be working early in the day, getting up, getting ready. And the show was called The Early Risers. It was all in Spanish, all Spanish language music, and Gonzalez's own kind of cheerful chit chat.
Aquí les traigo un corrido, oigan mis conacionales.
You know, we would call it like drive time radio, but people aren't driving anywhere. A lot of people are going to work in like fruit packing plants where they would listen in the plant as well. And he became a real resource for workers because the immigration laws were unbelievably brutal in the 1920s and 30s and specifically targeted at Mexican workers, Mexican migrant farm workers. It was really difficult to get work, to get paid regularly, to get good work. Gonzalez started using his radio show to tell people like where to go that given day, where like employers would come to him and say like, we need like 500 guys down at this dock or whatever. And he would make these announcements, but he also, so really helped people find work, but also began to really cultivate a lot of worker solidarity around working conditions and came to be considered by California businessmen to be a real threat to their ability to exploit Mexican workers. Gonzalez's story ends pretty tragically. He's forcibly deported after being arrested and he's framed for rape and prosecuted. It's a story about the power of California agribusiness, basically, to drive somebody out of the country. But it's just great. First of all, it's great to listen to him. I think it's really important to be reminded of the long and really continuous history of multilingual radio in the U.S. We interviewed a wonderful scholar from University of California, Santa Barbara, Inez Castillo, who is an expert on, she wrote a book called Sounds of Belonging about what radio did for immigrant communities at different moments in American history, but looking in particular at the 1930s and Spanish language radio. So it's really powerful, I think, to think about ways that radio can build community. It's easy to think about these kind of nationalistic, propagandistic uses, the kind of populism in the 1930s of, you know, Huey Long or of Father Coughlin. But I think we tend to forget about the you know, we would maybe call it grassroots radio
today,
and how powerful that form can be in building communities. And people that have local NPR stations know this, right? Like, you know what it means to hear the call sign for your local radio station. You feel something, I think, quite powerful. If you're a regular listener, a sense of like, oh, good, like I belong here. Mm. And that there are not enough different ways to belong in a constrained radio world.
I want to ask you about a moment in that episode, in this episode too. So you've told the story in the piece about, you know, the War of the Worlds, and you raise the question of whether it actually caused a panic or just that there was this story about the panic, that there's not, you say, there's not much difference between a panic and a story about a panic. In some ways, they both have the same kinds of lessons, I guess. But then you turn to this moment, this song sung by the African-American singer Paul Robeson, this anthem about belief and doubt. You describe it as the last act of the War of the Worlds. Would you talk about this moment? Because this is sort of how you bring this whole idea home, I think.
I have a huge soft spot for that ballad. I think it's beautiful. I love listening to Robeson sing it. And it is a story about the relationship between belief and doubt. And it captures a lot of ideas from the 1930s that I love. And it actually was an extraordinary radio phenomenon when it was broadcast live. Robeson sang it on CBS Radio.
Nobody who was anybody believed it. Everybody who was anybody, they doubted it. Nobody had faith. Nobody, nobody but Washington, Tom Paine, Benjamin Franklin, Chaim Solomon, Crispus Attucks, Lafayette, nobody.
Ballad for Americans became Robeson's signature song. An American creed sung with more power and resonance, maybe, because it was sung by an African American. The performance also made radio history. In the studio, the audience applauded for 2 minutes while the show was still on the air live, and then for 15 more minutes after the broadcast moved on. CBS's switchboards got jammed with callers wanting to hear it again. It was like a bizarro American corrido, all about truth and doubt, these truths of the Declaration of Independence, about how nobody who was anybody believed it, and everybody who was anybody doubted it.
Nobody.
Nobody's running a tea party at Boston.
Betsy Ross organized a sewing circle.
Yeah, Paul Revere had a horse race.
And a little ragged group believed it. And some gentlemen and ladies believed it.
Robeson, you know, sang this song on the radio and then apparently went out with friends to get a meal afterward, and they wouldn't serve him at the hotel. This is in New York City, right? So there's a lot to not believe in, and it's not a jingoistic song. It's sort of about how hard it is to believe in something, how deep our doubts can be, and and yet there's something about sound that can make you feel like you belong. That's why I loved ending with it, with the kind of challenge that it raises. There isn't really another thing that humans have invented besides a constitution that guarantees rights to all people, to all of its citizens. So we have a very flawed political community and a flawed constitution and many ways in which our society is unjust and was unjust at its founding and hasn't remedied those injustices. But there also isn't something better yet to guarantee equality and equal rights and dignity to everyone. And that's what I hear in Robeson. And like, that means a lot to me as an American.
Yeah, as you put it in the piece, the answer is not to doubt everything, because doubting at all is believing none of it.
Yeah, and believing none of it is a pretty miserable way to live.
Jill Lepore. Her podcast is The Last Archive. The second season is now underway. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Jill Lepore. We're talking about the new season of her podcast, The Last Archive. Episode 3, you really dig into this idea of how propaganda works, Nazi propaganda in particular. And it's a great story of Axis Sally, this American woman working for Nazi Germany. And this, I won't give too much away in this story, but I did want to ask you about an element of this episode, where you compare propaganda to poetry, and introduce the poet Archibald MacLeish. Talk a little bit about the role he plays in this. This was a nice surprise for me. I really liked this section.
Yeah, well, partly it was really hard to listen to all this Nazi propaganda for working on the script. The thing with Axis Sally, she was an American woman who worked for Radio Berlin, and she was later tried for treason. And because of the trial, the recordings that were collected by the FCC, which had a listening post in Maryland to capture Nazi shortwave broadcasts, these recordings exist because they were introduced at trial.
Yeah.
I think they also thought the recordings were so dangerous to listen to that the people who were at the trial, who had an official capacity, the members of the jury, the lawyers, and the judge, were given headphones. Like, it was too dangerous for everybody else to listen to. I mean, and it is actually horrible to listen.
It's horrible to listen. She's awful.
She's awful.
Do you say my country, right or wrong? No, Bill. That's false sentimentality. And I do not say my country, right or wrong. I love America. But I do not love Roosevelt and all of his kite boyfriends who have thrown us into this awful turmoil. Good night, girl.
So partly I was like, I need to listen to something else. And I love Archibald MacLeish and I love his poetry, but he was as close to kind of the American version of Joseph Goebbels because he was the anti-propagandist. Mm-hmm. He was the head of the Office of Facts and Figures, which later became the Office of Wartime Information, which is essentially the American government's propaganda outfit. But MacLeish, who was a very accomplished poet and also had been the Librarian of Congress, also a journalist, he thought his role as the head of the Office of Facts and Figures was to pursue what he called the strategy of truth, that the Nazis would just lie to their own people all the time and lie to everybody else, but Americans should do what Americans should do, which is tell the truth. And this was, during wartime, an untenable position for him to hold when there were things he was supposed to be lying to people about. Like, the story that's always told is there was a rubber shortage and people needed to be not using rubber because the rubber was needed for tanks. But FDR didn't want the Axis powers to know there was a rubber shortage. So he told MacLeish to say there was a gasoline shortage so that people would stop driving. So there'd be more rubber available because people wouldn't have to replace their tires so often. It's not the worst of all lies, but it's the kind of thing MacLeish didn't really want to do. So what I did instead, so I told that story, but I also spent a lot of time playing MacLeish's poetry because he wrote about what war does, which is unmake the world. He had seen his brother die in the First World War. He'd written beautiful poems about the cost of war, the meaninglessness in some way of war.
It was written at the time, 4 or 5 years after the First World War, when it began to dawn on some of us who had not been intelligent enough to have it dawn on us earlier, that war had been misfought and for nothing, and that those who had died in it had died pretty much for nothing.
As a poet, he did the work, as so many writers did after the First World War, of trying to remake the world through language. And I just loved the idea that there was a certain antidote to Axis Sally, that instead of just listening to her, we could listen to someone of good heart and decency and honesty trying to wrestle with the problem of atrocity and the loss of meaning that war brings.
I wanted to just say something about, just briefly about episode five, sort of dawn of the age of the hoax. And of course, you talk about this hoax, this idea that the moon landing was a hoax. And one of the things that you talk about is you have this theory that you mention in the piece that people like to have things that are mind-boggling. And the fact that we did this mind-boggling thing for real, land on the moon, sort of took that away from people. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say, look, I'm not sympathetic to people that think the moon landing was a hoax, but I am sympathetic to the idea that it's a vast epistemological chasm to cross from looking at the moon and with wonderment and astonishment and maybe reverence to looking at the moon as a place where you can picture Neil Armstrong's boot. Yeah. Like, it's just different, right? Like, we, you know, the sort of famous phrase that we live in a disenchanted world, you know, the aftermath of the long aftermath of the scientific revolution, where we submit nature to scrutiny and understand the workings of nature, deduce the laws of nature, all can be revealed. We can conquer time and space and conquer nature itself. And the kind of arrogance of that, right? But then there's no mystery left in the world. There's nothing enchanted left. And there are plenty of places that people go for that, right? Like, people of faith have that in their lives still. I'm mystified enough by my fellow human beings that I feel like there's plenty of mystification in my life. But there's a way in which a kind of the heavens fall, the what is continually receding farther and farther into the distance, is a sense of the sacred, the mysterious, and the enchanted. And so when people come up with all these crazy, crazy theories for hidden workings that lie behind it all, it seems to me a somewhat naturally unfurling of that need to think, I just don't know what really happened. You know what I mean? That like that for me is sort of worshipful and full of awe. But then the conspiracy theory version of it is full of suspicion and venom and paranoia and anger and resentment. It's really worth thinking through what changes in what we do know leave people suddenly feeling like we don't know anything.
Final question. In the end of that episode, you respond to this idea of whether there was a conspiracy to turn Americans into believers of conspiracies. And you sort of just come to the conclusion, like, no, it was, you know, the force of history. It was the exertion of, you know, power. And then you talk about the difference of between, you know, conspiracy theorists and historians. Maybe say something about that finally, because you say the historian always believes in reality, but it's not always obvious, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, having spent a lot of time reading the works of and listening to the broadcasts of people who don't believe that Americans ever landed on the moon, what you come away from spending any time with conspiracy theorists, including, say, QAnon people, is the delight that people take in doing the research, right? That, oh, I'm going to take this clue and that clue and this clue and that clue, and I'm going to piece them all together. And, you know, we have this kind of hackneyed notion of the, you know, newspaper clippings and the pin push pins and the rubber bands. And it's like a police room, right, where an investigation is ongoing. I very much get that. Like, I love piecing together an investigation. Like, I love collecting stuff. I love working on a wall or a big table. Like, we have a need, a human need. And there's this wonderful essay by Carlo Ginzburg that's a history of the clue. It's like, it just goes back to tracking. Like, we are tracking, like we hunt. Like, you have to, in order to live, you have to be able to track the signs that show you where to gather berries and where, you know, the deer went. Like, that is a human capacity, right? That is to say, to put together these little glimpses of evidence into a story that allows you to find what you're looking for. That is a very human capacity. And I think my own work as a historian is absolutely animated by that human drive. And it makes me more sympathetic to people gathering together all this evidence. But I think what they are missing is a theory of change. Well, how do things happen, right? Like, Marxists have a theory, and then everything fits into that theory. Or, you know, there's a kind of feminist theory that animates people's interpretation of the world. I have a theory of how change happens. I'm a historian. But if you don't believe, and you reject the social sciences, and you reject the Enlightenment, like, I don't know, I'm not sure, what then is your theory? Well, the theory can be that nothing is what it seems to be, right? But that's not, you don't just come to that. But that's what the remaining episodes in the season are about. How did people come to really so many Americans in particular commit to the idea that things are not what they seem. In the end, of course, the season is seeking to explain how people could believe that this election was stolen. That takes a century to get to that point.
Well, it's good fun getting to that point. Jill Lepore, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's Jill Lepore. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and a professor of American history at Harvard University. Her podcast is The Last Archive. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER, and like The Last Archive, you can subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program was produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.